Yeah, it's real.
Welcome to Still Entitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
I don't know what that tapping was, but did you guys hear that? Was that just in my head?
No, there are the people that live upstairs.
Oh.
Actually, when
that's all you
surface
to say.
Dwellers.
There are people that live upstairs.
I was here with John Roderick. He came to the cave and we're hanging out and he hears someone walk in. He goes, "Are there normals that live upstairs?"
This is the musician, yeah. John Roderick.
Oh boy.
So here's a piece of interesting news. The White House is having a maker fair.
I heard this morning. I think it is fantastic news.
Dude.
Did they just co-op the idea of a Maker Faire, or are they actually pairing with...
They're working with Maker Media.
Okay.
It's unclear when it's going to be or what exactly it's going to be involved, but it seems like from the thing that I read on CNET this morning that they're actually going to have a Maker Faire on the White House grounds. It's not like a Washington, D.C. Maker Faire. It's a White House Maker Faire. And of course, Make does, they commission, they allow mini Maker Faires to happen anytime. And they
Absolutely.
Basically, like you say you're going to do it, you sign up, sell a certain number of tickets.
70 or 80 a year happen in different parts
tons.
Of the world.
I think it's more than that now even.
Wow.
So
but then they send like a Maker Faire kit that then you use to like make your banners and
right.
do all that stuff. It's unclear whether this is going to be open to the public, when it's going to be. Like, I don't know how you bring in the stuff that makes, like, I don't know what the security clearance process is for a gas-powered or electric-powered robot spider that you drive like a tank. Like, I don't know if you can get that through the West Gate. I got to think the Secret Service is going to frown on the killer death robots and all
right.
the flamethrowers and all that
stuff. It's a Maker Faire, except it's only marshmallow guns.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's that famous photo of Obama and the kid when they had the science fair at the White House.
He was
with
in
the potato gun.
He was yeah. in Michelle's was, box
and
at the State of the Union.
And he was at Maker Faire. So is it going to be more like that, or it's science fair like, or?
Well, I want to go. That's all
yeah,
I'm saying.
I think we're all on board.
I'm totally on board with this.
Trip to DC. It sounds like a great idea.
You can bring stuff. You can make stuff.
Totally.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
going to send some pictures. I'm going to get in touch with them and see how I can help.
There's an application process. So
Excellent.
we'll put you in the right place.
Okay, good.
Can make a volcano.
I'm gonna make the volcano.
Baking soda and vinegar, man. That's all you need.
That never made sense as a science project.
No, it never did.
As like, well, and also when in elementary school and middle school, I guess when they had science fairs, a lot of those. When I had them, they were science experiments. They were supposed to help you test hypothesis and
right.
and figure it out. And you were never doing that with the volcano.
No.
At all.
There's an interesting thing that's happened with, because people are always saying to me, "Oh, I bet your kids are just the best at their science classes, aren't they? You help them out." And I say, "No. Why would I help them out?"
Yeah.
That they're not going to learn anything that way. In fact, not only do I not help them out, I anti-help them. I don't mean I make their science projects more difficult, but I'm like, I don't even want to know what you're doing. Because look at it this way. Everyone's already going to assume that you're coming home and tapping my brain, and they're going to assume that you're cheating. So wouldn't you rather be able to say to them that I had nothing to do with it? And both kids are like, "Oh, you're right." So one of my sons, thing one, is actually doing instead of a science fair at his school for the eighth graders, because they're all applying to high schools and are really occupied, they allow them to do like an invention.
Okay.
So my son is doing an invention. And I have no idea what it is. He's keeping it from me completely.
There's
wow.
no fear of tainting the Savage name.
Nope. And so, like, you know, he's
making
like,
the blue
could you bring home a
lab.
Hot glue gun? So I bring home a hot glue gun. Could you bring home some foam core? So I bring home some foam core. I have no idea what he's doing with
wow.
these things. That's very exciting.
I can't imagine what swimming lessons were like with you. Here, hold this cinder block. speaking of cartoon violence.
Is that nice? Well done.
We've never talked about animated movies,
which is shocking,
or animation really in
which
general.
So when we're talking about animation in general, that's surprising to me because, I grew up immersed in animation. My father was an animator.
Oh, of course.
My father was an illustrator. He's a painter. And he had gone to Pratt, he'd gone to the Cooper Union, and he'd gone to the Art Students League. And he'd also attended briefly the Academy di Belle Arti in Italy before getting drafted. What? Back when that happened.
For which one?
It wasn't for a war. My dad was drafted.
Oh, right. They used to draft people just because.
Tail end of the Korean War and sent to Germany.
Okay. That's, I mean.
Sit in a tank somewhere.
Sounds good.
But my father was an animator, and like a lot of animators out of the 1960s, people like Bob Bleckman, who started a company called the Ink Tank. You'd know him as the guy who did all the squiggly line Perrier animations when we were all kids.
Oh, okay.
Started out basically just thinking, well, I can draw, so I can probably animate, and kind of building careers animating.
Wow.
Because they were really good at drawing. And my father was one of those. There's this beautiful large format book on how to draw animation, and it shows you in-betweens and walking sequences and stuff. And my dad basically trained himself with that.
Is for drawing that kind of animation, is it like a precision thing? Is it that you just have to replicate your work very, very precisely? Or
yes,
is it?
So you start out with illustrations of what your characters are going to look like. And then as you move through the action, you record the soundtrack first, and then you keyframe to the animation, which means you know a character's going to walk across, so what's it going to look like when he's walking across? And you build, for walking, you'd build a walk sequence, however many frames. You're usually, for animations like for Winnie the Pooh and stuff like that, you're shooting on twos, which means it's not 24 frames per second, which is the speed of film. It's 12 frames per second,
okay,
which for animation, your eye doesn't really notice the difference that much.
And then they just double the frames in post, so you just do
two shots of each frame.
Okay.
And then you do what's usually, you go from keyframing to fleshing out the beats, and then you do what's called in-betweening. Mm-hmm. Where you actually literally, like, actually I was an in-betweener for a while at Bob Bleckman's company, the Ink Tank. They would give me two frames and I'd draw the frame in between.
So onion skin style.
Yeah. Except that you do it on onion skin and then you move to the cell. And then I was also a color matcher and painter. So I would paint the backs of the cells for the colors for the animation.
Paint by numbers for animation.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I grew up like until I was 21 and I was working as assistant animator. I just, I did animated spots for Nike back then, Swatch back when I was like 19, 18 years old. So animation is part of my life. That's what I want to say. And long way of telling story.
And when we're talking about animation, we're talking about 2D hand-drawn animation.
We're talking about what's generally referred to as cell animation.
Yeah. Cell animation. There's, in terms of like rigging and stuff for 3D, it's, you adopt a lot of the same ideas.
Yes, but we're talking cell animation. And when we say cell animation, for the uninitiated, this type of animation is every frame is drawn, but it's drawn in multiple layers.
Yes.
So if you have two characters, they're usually animated on two separate layers. And those layers, because they've got to be composited together in camera, are painted on acetate, clear celluloid film or acetate. And so somebody draws the animation in pencil. That's and then they shoot it just to make sure it works. That's a pencil test. Then the inkers and painters take those pencil frame animation drawings and transfer them onto cells where they then paint the back to give colors to the characters. This is how the Flintstones was done, Bugs Bunny, all the Disney films, and even a lot of modern films like Triplets of Belleville were done this way.
And then the background would be its own piece of art. It could be stationary. And when you're talking about effects, you said film. They are literally, there was a giant rig, several, two stories, three stories tall, where they stack the cells and a camera shoots down.
Yeah, but it's not, it doesn't have to be that tall. I mean, for the stuff my dad was doing, you would just stack three or four pieces of acetate per frame together to create all the elements,
right,
and you'd film them. The really difficult part is, no matter how clear your acetate is, if you have a color under one or two layers of it, it changes that color appreciably. Thus, you have to mix different colors for characters depending on which layer it's going to be in within
That's
the animation
really
composite.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is one of those things that, like, when we started talking about this, I thought, oh, I have a pretty good understanding of how animation works. And already I've learned that I have no clue.
Have you been to the Walt Disney Family Museum?
That is something I have not done, and I've heard
wonderful.
It is one of the great museums of the world.
Absolutely.
It's a very good museum.
It's so sad that the Walt Disney's daughter recently passed away. She founded the museum, but they have one of those giant two-story cameras. Not only do you stack your cells and have your backdrop, but the machines let you space out where the backdrop is, so you get illusions of depth and you can transition.
That's really advanced stuff. My dad had just this one thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things that, like, if you, in the arms race of making those films look better, Disney went to extreme lengths.
Oh, absolutely.
Of course.
They were defining the art form, not just at the forefront of it. Well, so speaking of Disney, I will tell my greatest missed opportunity story. which was when I worked at the Ink Tank for Bob Bleckman. And Bob was not only a wonderful illustrator and conceptual guy, animator, he had an incredible design eye. And he hired me. This is a great story. He hired me because my dad gave Bob his first job.
Ah,
that's okay. What he said. But he said, I don't know whether I can use you. I know I don't care where you went to school or what training you has. If you have an eye, I can use you. So here's what we're going to do. You're going to wrap my Christmas presents this year. And I want to see how you do. And he gave me a job based on how I wrapped his Christmas presents, because that told him what he needed to know about my skill base.
Now, there's two ways to look at this.
Detail. Yeah. There's a lot of matching the ribbons and the wrapping.
Well, like, I appreciate what you're saying. What you're going to say, like, wow, that's a really cheesy way to get your presents wrapped.
Well, there's two ways. Yeah, I don't like wrapping presents.
No. But I want to point out, this is Bob Bleckman. And although it's way in the past, and if you don't know Bob, it's hard to parse. But like when Bob gave me this assignment, these were to be wrapped and then wrapped again to be mailed. And he was really specific. Like, okay, I'm going to need you to go to, he said, there's only one post office where you can choose the cancellation stamp. So you're going to go to that one because I know the guy there, and you're going to ask him to show you the three different cancellation stamps he can put on this. And I want you to choose the one that looks the best. I mean, this was the level of crazy specificity. So,
there's some wax on, wax off shit.
So the thing I'm thinking as you tell the story is he was trying to see not only what your attention to detail was like, but what length you were willing to go to, what your commitment level was to get this job. Because I know over the years, Norm and I have had a lot of people come work for us who, if I had said, hey, I need you to go to the post office, they'd be like, well, that's not my job. And then that's the end of their relationship with us, pretty much.
Well, I was hired for 2 days just to wrap these wrap these executive gifts for him. And then I worked for him for a year and a half. In fact, I worked directly under J.J. Settlemyer. Now, J.J. Settlemyer's dad, Joe Settlemyer, directed the Where's the Beef Wendy's commercials back in the 80s.
Oh, those are great.
And his son, J.J., does all of the animation for Saturday Night Live.
Oh,
that's J.J. Settlemyer Productions, Ambiguously Gay Duo.
Yeah, yeah.
That's J.J.'s company.
Awesome.
He and I corresponded recently because he found some artifacts of my father's in his records, because my dad used to work with his dad. Our dads worked together. Anyway, we're still bad. We still haven't gotten past animation, the part of my history.
So where are the near miss?
Oh, the near miss. Right. The near miss is that Blackman's lead animator, when we were all doing a bunch of Perrier spots, was this wonderful woman named Tisa David. And Tisa David was one of the only female animators in Disney's retinue of animators. And she was incredible.
I assume that this was mostly a guy sitting around in rooms smoking cigarettes
It is. And so Tisa was a female animator and an amazing one. And every Tuesday night, she held a free class for the employees in animating. And it would be like,
oh, that's great.
This Tuesday, we're going to do a class on a handkerchief falling to the ground. Just that, all night, right? I never went to a single one of her classes. What?
Missed
what a training. Loser 18-year-old piece
just
of shit.
Just to be clear, what were you doing instead? Were you going to like Phil Collins concerts or something like that?
No.
Was there a girl?
Well, there was always a girl. Did you watch 30 Rock? I'm going to make you a mixtape. You like Phil Collins? I have two ears and a heart, don't I?
Okay.
But that's my missed opportunity. Tisa was a Disney animator. Now, my father also befriended another animator whose name was, Tanaka. Tanaka. My brother Pete's first girlfriend was named Jamie Tanaka, and she's a Japanese American in Nyack, New York. And her father was also an animator for Disney, who gave my father an animated cell of the complete painted Wicked Queen from Snow White, is like, I mean, the amount of growing up with animation, the amount of craft extant in this, where normal animation, it's all black line, right? Black outlines. This had like four colors just for the inking. Like her dress had red ink and her face was black ink, but her head, I mean, it was crazy beautiful. At a certain point, my dad spilled nothing less than paint remover on it.
Oh no, it's like it's the entire plot of Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yes. My dad actually just it sat in his studio for decades, and then at some point it was on a table and he spilled paint room and just totally destroyed it.
Those cells, there was a time when you could buy those cells incredibly cheaply, and then somebody at the Disney store was like, hey, I think when they launched those Disney stores in the 80s, said, hey, there's a market.
Yeah. And now they're
so did
hundreds
you
or thousands of dollars.
Disney films growing up, or like Disney films?
I did. I grew up with Dumbo and Snow White and
do you remember the first time you saw an animated film?
I'm actually not sure I could say. You know, I do remember, it's actually, if it's going to be anything, it would be the Winnie the Pooh on television, and also the stop motion animated Christmas specials, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and those things.
See, I have a really distinct memory of my mom taking me to the downtown theater, which shortly after turned into a porn theater, to see Fox and the Hound.
Oh, wow.
And we went on like the Saturday morning where all the kids were there. My young sister, who's probably an infant at that point, came.
Yeah.
And like that was it set the stage and created a lifelong love of those films for me.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that there's a better way to experience. Like absolutely remember I couldn't have been more than 5 years old.
Yeah. I always had seen them, you know, 101 Dalmatians, Lady and the Tramp, The Rescuers, The Borrowers.
Wow. You're talking about the downtime for Disney when they did The Rescuers.
Lady and the Tramp is not the downtime.
No, but Rescuers is when I was growing up, though.
And 101 Dalmatians, they were talking about Disney cheaping out and that's why they're the black lines.
101 Dalmatians was a cheap one?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that.
It was.
But the thing you probably don't understand this because you grew up in a time with home video. Mm-hmm. Like the only time you could watch Disney movies when I was a kid was when they were in the theater or when they were on TV on Sunday night.
Yeah. Oh, I'm aware of the vault concept.
Well, no. But more than the vault was an improvement over the old way, which was they would roll out the movies every 7 years or so.
Right.
And you could always go to the one theater in town and there'd be a Disney movie there probably three or four times a year. One would be the new one. And then the other three would be different stagings of the vault.
Right. Right.
And then they also had the Wide Wonderful World of Disney. Was that Wonderful on Saturday World or Disney, Sunday night?
Which
or something?
I would watch almost weekly. Remember watching that constantly.
And sometimes it was like a nature documentary.
No, right.
Sometimes it was I don't think it was ever
Did
a movie
Marty
though.
Did do some of those? I remember the nature documentaries extensively. Yeah. Yeah, I grew up totally inculcated with that stuff.
Yeah.
In the 90s, we all know Disney, there's a huge revival, and there's a great documentary, speaking of documentaries, about that revival. It's called Waking Sleeping Beauty, about how Disney was in the dumps. They did Black Cauldron. They did Rescuers. No one watched this. The Great Mouse Detective.
I loved that one.
Great.
I never
great
saw
movie.
That, actually.
And then with Little Mermaid. Had a string of successes through Lion King and then into the Pixar age. It's the history of animation.
Speaking of Pixar, we are not going to talk about Pixar here.
We are not.
That's 3D animation.
We can.
I think we should stay away from it.
I think I almost think we can even split out American animation and Japanese animation, talk about Japanese animation.
Oh, see, I wanted to segue from Disney to Miyazaki.
Oh, yeah, that also works for me.
I mean, just because it's that was like the second, renaissance for me in terms of discovering animation as a form. And I was working on, of all things, Home Alone 3.
Ooh.
And the art director of that movie.
They made a third one?
What's that?
They made a third
different
one?
Kid.
Yeah. The art director of that movie was an art director from Lucasfilm named Nilo Rodas. And Nilo's still around. I haven't seen him in a decade, but God, he's an amazing and weird and wonderful guy. Like, I really like the guy. And he said, this was before Miyazaki had come to the U.S. So the most recent film that had been made at this point was Nausicaa, Castle in the Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And no, Laputa. Nausicaa is Valley of the Winds. Laputa is Castle in the Sky. Not to be confused with Laputa, which I think is Italian for whore.
Okay. So that was the first one.
And Nilo said, go to Japantown, go to this video store there, ask them for Laputa and watch it. It's in Japanese. There aren't subtitles. It won't matter. He said the opening 10 minutes is one of the great movie openings ever shot in any medium, animation or otherwise. And he's totally right. The opening of Castle in the Sky is heart-stoppingly gorgeous and amazing. With a girl being rescued from the and falling out of
so when you watch anime and you love Miyazaki, we talked earlier about you loving Akira, which I mean, we're talking about high budget days. I mean,
Akira is what, early 80s?
Akira is early 80s.
The work ethic put into the animation and how much it cost and what they were afforded. You can't do that now.
Really?
It's too expensive.
I don't think that. Movies, well, but like the Three Sisters movie. What's that? The French movie.
Belleville?
Triplets of Belleville.
The amount of detail put into just the frame by frame and how much intricate in terms of like the electronics and they would cut that out.
So my son came home from school a couple of weeks ago and he goes, "We watched the craziest movie in French class. I couldn't make any sense of it." And without even knowing any more than that, I said, "Triplets of Belleville." And he goes, "Yes. How did you know?"
It's a delightful movie.
But so, I mean, even I'm not sure I realized this. Even the current Miyazaki films like The Wind Rises and Ponyo are shot on a much lower budget?
I think they're a much lower budget, or what you get out of that budget is much lower.
Because, I mean, for me, so I watched Castle in the Sky several times on video. And then the first big exposure of his that I went and saw in the theater, which was now probably 12 years ago, was when Spirited Away came to
the
theaters.
That was the first thing I saw in the theater.
And it was a bunch of us from ILM that all went because we had all become separately Miyazaki fans. And that was the first big American splash of a Miyazaki film. And it is in my top 10 movies, let alone whatever format. Spirited Away, obviously I made my no face. I love that movie so much. I find it so upsetting and great. And
Princess Mononoke, My Neighbor Totoro, those are like the first ones to come into America. And they're kind of re-releasing them now because Disney has the rights for U.S. distribution. And so that's why when you have like...
Totoro is totally beautiful. But I mean, even the really weird ones like Nausicaa Valley of the Winds, Patrick Stewart's on that soundtrack and it's amazing.
I'm not the biggest fan of them going back and redubbing it and just getting the celebrity voices. When they do the new ones, for example, the one based on the Borrower's book, I think it's the Arrighetti, was it 2 years ago they did?
Yes.
And Will Arnett and his ex-wife, Amy Poehler, they do the voices on there and they're great, but they cast those like almost concurrently right after the movie was made.
There's a conversation about like celebrity voices that are recognizable in animation kind of bum me out.
Not recognizable at all. Those two.
I find with Miyazaki, I can do the suspension of disbelief and I always know I'm going to hear John Ratzenberger at some point.
That's okay. I'm totally, Ratzenberger is good. Ratzenberger at this point is a voice actor, right? Yeah. I'm talking about, and I'm not talking about the Pixar stuff like Woody Harrelson.
Woody Allen.
Tim Allen.
Tom Hanks.
Yes. Like those work because those characters work. But I'm talking more about the like the DreamWorks stuff where they get not even Mike Myers as Shrek, but pretty much every other celebrity casting that they do in the DreamWorks.
Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
Eddie Murphy. I see. Or if you're black, you can play a donkey. Sorry, I'm quoting Chris Rock.
Yes. You've been Academy Awards. And that'll do it for us forever. We'll see you guys later. It's been a great run.
So with Miyazaki movies, there is a whole pantheon of them, and he has announced and has finished his last one.
Yeah, but he said that a couple of times already.
He's pretty old, though, right?
He's getting really old. He let his son direct a couple of his Studio Ghibli movies, and people weren't as happy, not as good.
You know, the thing is about his sensibility. His sensibility for wonder and for a genuine sadness in a kid's movie. Like a real sadness. Like there's a part in Spirit Away where she just breaks down and cries.
Like the first time I saw that, I couldn't believe it was a children's movie.
I know.
Right? I thought, oh, this is like Akira. It's cartoons for grownups. I like that.
But I've raised my kids on Miyazaki because I like those difficult emotional issues that it brings up. And I think that was really good to get a kid to see that stuff is real. Well,
and don't show them, as that Miyazaki movie, Grave of the Fireflies.
That is the one I have not seen.
It's not Miyazaki, but it's an animated movie that's heart-wrenching and okay. it is depressing.
Well, and I like the Studio Ghibli approach. I find it much more honest than the traditional Disney, hey, let's just make you cry in the third act by killing the dog yeah. or the fox or whichever one it happens to be.
Right.
Like it's a very cheap melodrama in a lot of cases, in especially those older Disney movies.
Now,
and with Miyazaki, I mean, Howl's Moving Castle, is just, there's so much going on and you're always fascinated where stuff shows up. It feels very much like a dream in the same way that, you know, dreams was like, and then I was running and I was wearing gold shoes, you know, like this stuff just starts happening and you go with it. And the films sort of define their own reality and you're just along for the ride.
Kaleidoscopic.
And Totoro is a great version of that. Yeah. And Totoro is actually, for those listening with young kids, Totoro, you can, without fear, show that to the youngest possible child. Totoro is totally accessible and not scary. Mm-hmm. Just really, really sweet.
One of a great Miyazaki, I don't know if you've seen this, Steven Spielberg's favorite is his Lupin the Third, The Castle of Caligari.
That's another one I haven't seen.
It is a pure adventure movie. A character that's one of the most famous heroes in animation in Japan. And Miyazaki did a movie.
Oh, okay.
About that character.
Oh, also, Porco Rosso.
I haven't seen that. I want to see that.
Porco Rosso is wonderful.
World War One fighter pilots with
yes.
the pig.
Yeah. Oh, it's really good.
I want to see that.
Wow. Sounds great.
It's really, really great.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's.
But then there's Akira, which is like a genre definer and almost. Who's backing up right in front of the shop? Right
I was going to say.
Jesus Christ.
Just a little bit. Just bring it on in.
Mom back. Whoa.
Not too close.
I had to teach my wife at one point. She has me. What did she do? She was going like this. And I was like, what? And she was like, just a little more. And I'm like, this does not mean just a little more. This means stop. You're about to run over a baby.
Yeah, is the normal language. If you're looking at someone and they're helping you, you do like, how much space
yes.
you have? And you just go like that.
And stop. This
and then
stop.
Stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other one is if you imagine where your hands are, and if your hands couldn't see my eyeballs in the mirror, then your hands are invisible to me. So when you hold them up here like this, I know that normally would be great visibility, sweetheart.
Uh-oh. So wait. I'm going to go back to Akira,
yes.
yeah.
which is really like its own premonitory in animation because it's so remarkable and so far out and so fucked up. I mean, I love that movie.
The third act in that is you don't see that coming.
No.
Not at all what you expect.
But close to it is my second favorite of the Matrix movies, not the second and third ones. It's the Animatrix.
The Animatrix stuff is unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
All of it. Even the Final Fantasy ones are good.
And so to give you a clue, this is the Wachowski siblings hiring 8 of the best animators in Japan, right? They were all Japanese or were they from all over the world?
Was it all Japanese?
All Japanese.
And having them each illustrate plots that occur between The Matrix and Matrix
2.
Yes.
Reloaded.
And they'll make you mad because it turns out that the Wachowskis can write really good Matrix plots. It's just that the second and third movies aren't them.
Well, the thing about those films is that they do this thing that happens badly in most extended universes. So they fill in the plot holes and they give backstories for the supporting characters all the way down through.
To the fight between the humans and the machines.
Oh yeah, the history, the prequel stuff.
It's totally intense.
Right,
yeah.
It's so good.
The new Renaissance.
It's basically the best of the Planet of the Apes, but with robots instead of apes.
So which is your favorite of the 8?
Probably the one with the kid.
The kid spontaneously jumping?
Yeah.
That's pretty beautiful.
I also really, really liked the one with the girl.
And the missing cat.
Yeah.
That's the one that's my favorite. That's the one that's the most real. Yeah.
It's the most Spirited Away-like.
It is very Spirited Away-like. Yeah. But I also love the one of the runner, the Aeon Flux style.
That one's great.
He runs and then he breaks out. And you're like, that's just a whole mental thing. I mean, they're all great. There's the one where the robot falls in love with the woman. and when they're, and she's like hacking in, and then he like destroys.
Is that the
her.
One where they're on like this, they're outside in the real world and they're on like a, on a ocean promontory or something?
Something like
that. Or is that something else?
No, there's, yeah, there, I just watched about half of it about a week ago.
It's the Samurai Fight one with the rooftop.
Yeah, which is
fighting.
The animation is so weird and overly stylized. It's really, really great. Really worth watching.
Mm-hmm. And they're not long. It's probably an hour all told.
Yeah.
Maybe an hour and a half.
Maybe, yeah. As far as other movies like that have come out, you know, everyone was like, Ghost in the Shell is amazing. And I liked Ghost in the Shell. But when you talk about it, is whatever happened to the director of Akira? Can you tell me? Because
I don't have any idea.
Not something I know.
Apple, what's the, Norm, you'll know this.
Appleseed.
Appleseed, right. I really liked.
Okay. I have not seen that.
I it's been a long time since I watched it, but I remember I watched that in like the mid 2000s probably and really liked it a lot.
Oh, I also really liked Metropolis.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that.
Metropolis is very intense, super epic in scale and scope and really beautiful. And it is also a fight between the robots and the humans.
So we're talking about films, but in animation, in television, Japan does the same thing that the UK does in terms of limited series. So they'll have a studio and maybe a visionary director. They'll work together and they'll do 26 episodes of one show. It's not like, you know, Pokemon or something. Where it's
is like high
years.
Concept stuff or is it?
No, not necessarily. So you have a show like, and you can't, we were remiss to not mention Cowboy Bebop as one of the most popular.
Yeah.
You know, they have a corgi in there. I hear about that a lot.
There's a very cute corgi in there. But, but it's just, you know.
Were you just staring at the camera again?
Oh, you have a corgi. It's like, it's either the Queen's Ayn. Dogs or Ayn.
Oh, okay.
Ayn's name of the corgi.
I had to find out who Ayn was after I got the corgi.
Is it Ayn Rand?
No.
E-I-N.
Oh, good.
And it's a limited series. But again, like we were talking about anthologies in earlier podcasts, you get your beginning to end. It's one vision.
Yeah.
And it's not about filler. And they can spend a lot of money on the animation and it looks good.
Awesome. Hey, you know, speaking of nothing in particular,
okay,
you were reminding me about dogs and we're talking about robots. Does any of our listeners have an old Aibo ERS 210, the original Aibo dog robot lying around?
I'm sure someone will.
We might even have a friend who has one of those.
Because I would love to, I've always wanted to play with one, but I'm just not willing to spend what it takes to buy one. I was looking at them.
So you'd like to dog sit somebody's pet
I'd like
robot
to dog,
dog
sit somebody's robot dog.
Are you ready to be disappointed?
Yes.
It chases the
I have a
ball.
Pleo up there, and Pleo's lovely.
I never actually played with a Pleo.
Pleo's pretty nice.
That's a dinosaur.
I'll have to see if I can. Oh, the battery's more than 5 years old. I'll have to have it reconditioned.
Yeah. You know, we didn't talk about stop motion animation
at
all.
No, stop motion animation, I also grew up doing and playing around with.
Yeah.
And with, because we were inculcated with the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer films. And then actually, I owe my special effects career to Henry Selick's films, Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach. Not because I worked on them, the opposite, because they used so many model makers and mold makers and painters and set dressers in San Francisco that there was nobody available when Jamie Hyneman was looking for people to work for him. And I got the job.
That's when Disney did a three movie deal with Henry Selick after Nightmare Before Christmas. And they're like, we're going to make so many of these stop motion movies. And they, after James and the Giant Peach, did nothing.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, Nightmare is so beautiful and so immersive and incredible. And actually, the more you know about how they made it, actually, when you know about how they made it, it's twice as amazing.
Really? Because it's a gorgeous movie.
For instance, every movement of Jack Skellington's face is a hard sculpt.
Hard sculpt, not 3D print.
Wow.
Hard sculpt. They had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Jack Skellington heads.
They had to have thousands of them.
I've got six right there. Thousands. All
was the mouth
of every
different?
Single
Did the
one
mouth move?
The mouth moved. Here, wait. Let me just, I'll hold on.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's okay. Wow.
It's why they're very expensive to make, those the stop motion movies. There we go.
Holy cow. Wow. Yeah. I mean, even the later stuff, Corpse Bride is great. Coraline is one of my favorite animated movies of all time.
Oh yeah.
It is such a, and talk about your grim stories to tell children.
Neil definitely understands
button
that.
Eyes. Well, yeah, the have you read the Graveyard book?
I have not yet.
You should read the Graveyard book. It's
I
really good.
I have just haven't gotten around to it. Neil, yes.
He understands how to scare children in exactly the right way.
He does. He's a good friend. He just sent me a signed edition of the Graveyard book.
Oh, it's so good.
Very beautiful.
We read Tuesday. his children's
oh,
children's
yes,
book.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's about a panda. It's the little boy who cried wolf. Oh. Told another way with a panda.
Okay, so wait, anyway, about these faces. So every single character, same thing.
So, some of those scenes have tons and tons and tons of characters.
So, I mean, you would, it's mind boggling how much work went into this. The armature for Jack Skellington, the animation armature. Now, animation armatures are basically built today the same way Willis O'Brien built the armature that's underneath King Kong, which is, it's a set of metal steel ball joints and tightening screws that allow you to both move it and it holds its position so that the lighting and the camera can get their shot. The Skellington armature is so thin and so fine, it took a year to build the armatures for Jack.
Oh, my God.
A year. It's crazy. So in special effects, when you're working on models, you are often working, you're working for weeks on the tiniest thing. And it's, you know, which means that somebody's paying $100,000 for this little thing that you guys are working on, right? And when you do that and you're sitting there and you're bored, you got to joke around, you know? And so you're like telling stories and you have conversations that are really standard for model makers. Like, what's the worst possible way to die? Right. And so, you know, everyone has crazy ideas. And at ILM, you know, you finish a model, like we finished the space shuttle from Space Cowboys, and then you've got to get it across the street over to the shooting stages. So this model that seven people just spent 10 weeks on, it's probably like $500,000 worth of labor in this thing. You could literally push it across traffic to get it on set. Right. And it's not that big a deal, but it's always something you're thinking about, like, what's the worst thing I could do? So I'll tell two stories here. One is, did I tell the story about ILM
you've
when
told
I first
us,
got there and
not,
the whip?
Not on air.
Okay. So when I first got to ILM, which is 1998, I wanted to make a splash. So I was very conversational with my new colleagues about all the things that I could do. So one of the things I told them is, oh, I made a whip. And I taught myself whip making because it had happened fairly recently. And they're like, well, you should bring your whip in. So a couple days later, I brought my whip in. Now, at this point, it's late in the production process for Episode 1 Star Wars. And over on one of the sound stages off of Kerner Boulevard in San Rafael, California, they have gathered all of the models and sets from Star Wars. There's full-size battle droids. There's R2s. There's the Federation battleships. There's the Naboo fighters. There's the Queen ship. All of these in various stages and various sizes. This is the last Star Wars movie to be almost all model driven, except, you know, including the CG. In addition to the CG, tons of these ships were built as models.
Yeah.
So they're all in this one room, and I'm working in this room on one of the sets from Naboo. And my supervisor comes in, Brian Grenan, and he goes, dude, I heard you got a whip over here. I want to see that. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, can you crack it? And I'm like, I can only do one kind of crack and it's over my head. And he's like, oh, well then get up on the table. So I get up on the 4x8 table and my whip is like 13 and a half feet long. And I'm like, crack. And Brian's like, the look on his face is like red and like, yeah. And I'm like, ma, crack. This like ear splitting sound. And I look around and I realize I'm swinging a 13 foot long bullwhip in this room with like millions of dollars of expensive models.
Oh my God.
I could end this entire career arc right now. Luckily, I didn't hit a thing. But suffice to say that as a stress reduction technique, thinking about how you could destroy the expensive thing you're working on is a constant thought process. Now, I was having this conversation with a friend of mine. I haven't seen him in years, but I used to work with him. He's a wonderful model maker named Kundo Rabadi. Kundo's very, very twisted sense of humor. And we were talking about what's the worst thing. And he goes, oh, I'm about to end this conversation. And I was like, why? And he goes, because I thought of it. And I was like, what? What could be the worst thing you could do? And he goes, no. This is it. Nothing will ever come close. He says, you want to do the worst thing possible for a movie. You go to the character face room at Skellington. So this is while they were filming Nightmare Before Christmas. They had like 9 or 10 different sets set up at the same time, shooting different parts of different scenes with a different animator on everyone.
You don't need the actors?
What's that?
You don't need the actors on each set?
Yeah. And in a room, there's a locked room that has all the thousands of Skellington faces and Sally faces and Mayer's faces, et cetera, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just all of them lined up, all of them on shelves for animators. Oh, I need Jack to say this word. I need these seven faces, right?
Hear the sounds involved.
Yeah. So Kundo's Kundo's worst possible thing ever. He says, go in there in that room with a handful of glitter.
Oh my God.
And just go. The glitter will cover everything. Little bits. You can try and clean it. You won't ever be able to get it all off. And then somewhere in somebody's shot, there'll be a mirror like reflection off of Jack's face and it'll ruin the whole shot.
What
Yeah.
What is it Bonnie Burton says about glitter?
It is the herpes of crafting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And oh, that's that note,
yeah. That's I don't, the that's worst. It.
That is it. That would you'd literally have to shut down production because it was a year's worth of work just making all those faces.
You've told us the bullwhip story before. I know what you're going to do. And I just because we go in places like that and shoot. Sometimes we interview people when there's work like that going on.
Yeah.
And I just, especially the stop motion stuff, those guys are so detail focused.
Yes.
And like if you jostle the camera or if you bump into a curtain or anything, it just ruins their whole day.
Oh yeah. The spider in James and the Giant Peach. That spider web. So think about trying to make a character that can walk across a spider web. They were having trouble with, and they stretched it out of piano wire.
Yeah.
And even still, they would film all day with it, and then the next morning they'd come in, and if they started filming too early, the web would pop because the heat had slightly changed the shape of the piano wire.
Oh my God.
During the day, and then it had cooled down at night, so you had to let it warm up again. That's the kind of stuff they were confronting.
That's
constantly.
Nightmarish.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, and on that note, I think that'll do it for us. As always, there's good stuff on tested.com on any given day. We also have premium video features that are rolling out all the time. Adam watched the Zero Theorem trailer, which is Terry Gilliam's newest movie. It's up there. You saw it for the first time.
Live reaction.
We captured
Very
that.
Cool.
We
Very
talked
cool.
about it a little bit. So if you want to find out about that, you can go to tested.com/premium.
And the NSA was also probably filming on my laptop.
Oh, of course.
Camera.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they, if you're in the NSA, you could go watch that extra feature.
Yeah. They got two angles. Maybe I can get it from them. I just wish the NSA would tell me all the stuff that I can deduct when I do my taxes so that I don't have to. They want to spy on me and track everything I do online. Yeah. That's fine. That's great. Give me the extra benefit. We'll see you guys next week with another episode of Still Untitled.
Thanks so much, guys.
Bye.